Okay, if we need more, we'll get them. And but here's Kevin.
Thank you, Mr. George. So what George forgot to tell you, I don't think it was a half an hour when I was in his office. It was hours, and he and Jane were going someplace. There was some party or gathering, and so George said, "Hey, I've got to meet with this kid. Just wait out in the parking lot." And I think at least 2 hours later, Jane is still out there waiting and waiting. And so, kingdom business was taken care of, and I'm always so certainly appreciative of George, but that Jane didn't come pounding on the door and say, "Come on, wrap this thing up." So, I am honored to be here today. I really appreciate this opportunity to share some things with you. And Jackie, we were just chatting a few minutes ago, and how much we enjoy this opportunity to work together. Jackie has been a mentor and a friend of mine for many years. I've had a private practice in the same office that she's at for 11 years, and so prior to graduating from George Fox, Jackie made it so that when I did graduate that next week, I had a little office in her building where we rent space from a law firm. And by little office, I mean it made a broom closet look big. But it was a fantastic opportunity to graduate, have an office, and then I needed a clinical supervisor as I put together my hours before licensure. And so Jackie was also my clinical supervisor for several years as I was putting together my 2,500 face-to-face hours that a therapist needs, and then someone like Jackie is there to rock me as I'm just going, "I don't know if I can do this, I don't know." But she's just been fantastic. as we're gushing over each other. But it's wonderful to have people like her as a mentor. So let's just jump in here. Now, I put made font big enough so I didn't need my glasses. I may have to put it right there so I can see it. One thing that Jackie has always reminded me of, and when we meet and we do our peer supervision, is just the importance of being a compassionate therapist. Compassion means what? To suffer with is what compassion means. From the gut is a definition that I've heard. So when you're with someone, it's a visceral thing. And that as therapists, we sit and we hear stories shared with a great deal of vulnerability. Therapists, we're not diagnostic machines that sort of sit there and listen and then, look for the appropriate intervention, some sort of a template that we put over clients and then, you're number 47, so we fill that in and have you do things. No, that we're there to model, in a lot of ways, feelings and thoughts for our clients. And so, as with that, pardon me, just one second. I guess the point of that is saying that as therapists and being up here today, this isn't about us being superheroes or perfect or, we've got it down. No, not at all. It's a process for everyone. It's an experience for everyone, and we're in it as well. It's something that we do every single day, and we absolutely love it. We think it's the best job in the entire world, but we're in no way coming up here, as all-knowing. We're sharing things that we've learned and, really devoted our lives to, information acquiring. So we get to share that with you and really join in with you as we're all trying to become more emotionally wise. So I got to do this. Ah, there it is. Hallelujah. Oh, I love glasses. I just didn't want to do this and this, but I'm going to do it. So when I think of the word, you know, I know exactly. I should try to do that. So when I think of the word, you know, isn't wise emotional living, isn't that sort of like an incongruent title? I don't know, wise emotional living. When you think of emotional living, you don't think of wisdom. You just think of, I'm out of my mind, and I'm my emotions are all over the place. And how does wisdom come into play? Whenever I hear the word wise, some of the first descriptors, I think of trial. Somebody that's wise, I think of trials, I think of scars, I think of victory, I think of trauma, I think of experimenting. Whenever I think of the word wise or somebody that is wise, I think of experience. And so not somebody that just sort of enters in, just walks into a room and they're all knowing and all seeing. No, somebody that's wise, I believe, has been through it. So I think wise emotional living, as strange as that sounds, with my sort of description or definition of wise, then it makes sense. Wise emotional living, taking the experiences that we have, internalizing them, owning them, and then applying them, you know, each day. Or, you know, last year was hard, but I learned a lot. So this year, I've got a little bit more wisdom. Now, I've got a limp because of last year. You know, I've got some scars because of last year, but I'm a little wiser. So we're all in the midst of this, so be patient. Be patient with yourselves. Certainly be patient with yourselves as you're listening today. So I worked at Jasper Mountain, which is a residential center for kids from, you know, ages 6 to 13. Worked there for about 4.5 years. And, you know, some of these kids have experienced more fill-in-the-blank in their lives than most adults, you know, their entire lives. And, you know, these kids, they were so preoccupied with surviving, staying safe, staying out of the way, healing in their family of origin or where they were raised, that, you know, the idea of wise emotional living wasn't even on their radar. I worked with many kids that when they would arrive, they didn't even know how to play. We had to teach them how to play, how to stack blocks, how to, you know, color, how to imagine things, because they were so fearful and frightened and just trying to survive. But it was an incredible experience, and one woman by the name of Mary Gross, relative of hers, she was a mentor of mine at Jasper, and she and I would teach trauma classes to these little kiddos. And she was and is an amazing individual. And so what we would do with these kids in teaching them understanding their emotions, Mary had just a really simple and effective way of helping the kids acknowledge, identify, understand, and express their feelings. So we would teach the kids that feelings are messages that require identification and often interpretation. And so that's kind of my basis today, is sharing with you what we would teach 6 to 13-year-old kids. And for me, it's perfect. I love it. That's how old I feel half the time. Right there, 12 and a half, really, for me. So that's what we're going to do. So the basis of this is first to acknowledge that I am indeed experiencing a feeling. What's coming up in my chest, what I'm feeling in my gut, in my body, given a certain situation, what I'm feeling. Second is to learn to identify what this feeling is, to name it, and is this feeling really what I'm experiencing? Next, try to understand where it came from. What is the cause of this feeling, this sensation that I'm experiencing? And finally, what do I do with this? What does this feeling seek? What is this feeling looking for? And I love that when Mary would talk about this feeling, you know, she would, with each one of the feelings we're going to talk about, what does this feeling seek? What does happiness seek? What does fear seek? What does anger seek? Wow, what a concept. You know, the feelings are messengers. You know, it's data, really. I like, you know, somebody told me, feelings are data, not destination. You know, it's data. It's information coming up and feeling it. It feels like there's a washing machine inside of you, you know, or a train rolling through your head that's overwhelming and I can't stop it. But it is data. You know, it's information. And so what is this feeling seeking? What does it want me to do? And I love that. It simplifies, and it really helps me a lot. So it's not this simple. There are a ton of variations, combinations, and the process does not always end up being, you know, linear. Everybody know that? Emotions are not a linear, simple kind of a thing. Up, down, backwards. So I like to think of this process as attempting to become Neo from The Matrix. I love that, where he's, you know, standing there and bullets are coming at him, and he does this, slows down time, and he starts, you know, backing up, and here comes this bullet, and he sees the next one coming that way. That's how I like to think of processing emotions, you know, when they're coming at you at 8 billion miles an hour. So what, next time that you're, you know, with your kids and they're acting up and you've got all these emotions, or you're with your spouse or a significant other and you've got all these emotions come up, just do this. And just do it, and just, that'll just freak them out. And they'll just say, I'm emotionally processing, okay? So just start doing this stuff and real slow like that. It'll help out a lot. It's a real icebreaker. My poor wife. Oh my gosh. So let's take some basic emotions here and break them down using this format. Excuse me. So we're going to start with anger. Yay. Okay. So what I've got. Some emotions here. I'm just going to read, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. So anger is what we experience when we are wronged in some way. So we go out to the parking lot, and somebody has backed into our car. Nice dent, scratch, maybe a broken window, taillights, and there's no note, nothing like that. You know, you just show up, and there it is. I'm angry. Somebody has done that and not left a note, not let me know what's going on. So it is anger. Pretty simple. You're feeling it, your body, your heart's racing. Everybody does anger a little bit different. Chest is pounding, you know, hands are clenched. What is the message? What do you do with that? I mean, when you see that, and immediately, what are you going to do? For me, I'm looking up, and I'm like, okay, who did it? Who did it? We know, here's the sensation. This is what's going on, and we're wanting to name who did it. Okay, obviously nobody's there, but you're thinking what? Well, I would like somebody to apologize for their misdeed. I would like somebody to go to jail for the rest of their life for doing this to my car. I would like to physically embrace them and hug them for a very long time. We want justice. We want to squish them, yes. Anger seeks justice. When we've been wronged, somebody's done something wrong to us, we want justice. Now, you can take any number of examples, and maybe through your head you're kind of running down a list. When somebody's wronged you, they've said something, done something, it seeks justice. Okay? So we'll come back in just a few minutes. Fear. Fear can be a real threat, a perceived threat, or an intense anxiety or worry of what may happen in a given situation or the future. So a child believes that there is a monster under their bed and feels intense fear. The kiddo's not sure, you know, what to do or how much danger he's in. So what does every smart child do? He calls, you know, Mom! Dad! Come in here and expose yourself to this monster. I don't really care about you. I'm afraid. I'm in fear. The child can't predict what's going on. Doesn't know what's going to happen. So fear seeks safety. Mom and Dad are safe. When we're a child, I mean, they're everything, right? So of course they can come in and take care of any monster, but fear seeks safety. Fear seeks safety. Even in when there's anxiety, you know, that part of fear to predict. We want to know it's going to be okay. We want to know it's going to be okay. We want to know that it's going to be safe. We're going to be safe. Family's going to be safe. So the next one is sadness. Sadness is a feeling we experience primarily from a loss of some kind. Sadness is a void. We've lost something or someone for forever, and we spend a great deal of time and energy coming to terms with this loss. We feel stuck in one place, and we look back at our loss while the world is moving forward. We're still looking back, and everything else is going ahead, and we're stuck, and we're watching. And we're just trying to figure it out, all the questions of what's going on, why. Sadness seeks comfort. Sadness seeks compassion. Someone to sit with me. But someone to sit with me at my place. At my place in this. Not in theirs. Not in where they think I should be or should go, how fast, how soon. But at my place and at my pace is that comfort, that compassion when somebody loses something. Because, boy, isn't it? Loss is so subjective. It's so subjective. If I'm losing something, what I deem is so important, somebody else, it can be very easy to, well, just judge and say, well, it's not that big of a deal. But sadness seeks comfort. It seeks somebody to be with me at my place and at my time. Okay. How about happiness? Who's for talking a little bit about happiness? Kevin the Downer up here. Okay. It is very important to be wise with our happiness, to understand it, to know where it comes from, to know what it seeks. So happiness can be that feeling of subtle contentment or fulfillment or peace you experience at a dinner table with friends or family. You know, all is right. There's some people in here that I've had many meals with and sat down with them and just, all is right. There's just this sense of peace, and this is good. There's not, you know, it doesn't be fireworks or loud or a band or a game. It's just, this is good. All is right. Happiness can be the experience of exuberance, pride, accomplishment when you've conquered a video game or purchase a new set of golf clubs. I don't know what that would even feel like, George. I don't know. I mean, there's apparently something pretty exuberant about buying new golf clubs. Happiness can be when you're in a giant corkscrew going 60 miles an hour, 100 feet up in the air on a roller coaster. That's ridiculous. But it's pretty fantastic. Strangely, you're happy. You're screaming. I've cried out to my mother when I'm on roller coasters before, make me safe. But then I'm getting on with my fast pass again and again. I love it. I want to do it more. So happiness seeks more. Happiness seeks more of this sensation. Happiness says that you should continue to be with these people, accomplish goals, or thrill seek. Of course, so what? Here's the caveat, in moderation. happiness can be used as a medication or a short-term solution to the more difficult emotions we discussed above. Okay, so what's the purpose of this format? So what we would tell the kids at Jasper is how important it is to get to know, to understand, to sit in, and experience their emotions. So there are combinations of emotions sometimes, and sometimes there are misinterpretations. There are different intensities of emotion, frequencies, how often these emotions happen, how often they come up, and different durations of feelings. You know, some emotions just kind of show up, maybe a little anger, maybe some happiness, they kind of show up and then bam, you know, they're gone. So there are all kinds of variables where emotions are concerned. So feelings can be so complicated depending on your age, circumstances, your health, your belief system, your past. Sometimes it's just easier to disregard, ignore, or medicate your feelings. But if you're not, excuse me, if your feelings are not acknowledged, identified, or you know, you're attempting to understand them, they do find a way out. You know, they do find a way out. The trauma, you know, I work with a lot of vets, a lot of different people that have trauma, and that means a lot of different things to different people. It's a hard example, but one I think that is important. A big part of the healing process is looking at how we felt when those experiences happened. Whether it's the sadness, the fear, the anger, confusion. And so we go back and we talk, and we gently sometimes re-experience those feelings. And they come up, and it's a surge. So it's this ebb and flow. You know, it comes up, and it recedes like a wave, and recedes like a wave. Initially, when we're re-experiencing these things, it's like a foghorn that somebody comes and puts in your face, or right behind your head. You know, here's this bah, really loud, and you just jump out of your skin. And some of those first times that you're experiencing those feelings again. And as you keep returning back, getting to know these feelings, acknowledging these feelings, what these feelings are asking of you, slowly but surely, that foghorn gets a little bit less intense. It kind of gets to a point where when it goes off in your face, you give it a blink, sort of a little bit of a turn, but it's not the disruptive, you know, head-shattering experience that you had initially. So it's important to take a look at those to get to know them, understand them, because they're gonna come out, whether it's depression, you know, avoidance, anxiety, addiction, violence, struggles at work or as a parent or as a friend. You know, it's impossible to stuff the difficult feelings and expect to experience happiness, contentment, joy, you know, in its fullness, or expect that to remain high. It's only when we get to know those more difficult feelings, you know, and you can imagine, as I'm thinking right now, that here comes wisdom. Here's the hard stuff that you're going through with your feelings and experiencing them that's building wisdom. But only when we're experiencing those, getting to know them, can we really, you know, have emotional balance. So what it's kind of like, in my head I'm thinking about an equalizer. Anybody, do we even make equalizers anymore? Yeah, you know, when you're listening to music and you got the different You've got volume, you've got the mids, the highs, the lows, and they're all kind of, they're bouncing around a bit, you know, as you're hearing the music. If your sadness and anger and fear and all of that in your equalizer, if they've got you down, if they're really pressing you down, to think that you can feel happiness, joy, contentment, and you know really have that on your equalizer way up here. It's not going to happen. That happiness is going to sound probably tinty, fuzzy. It's not going to be in its fullness because you've got all these experiences, these feelings that you don't know where they're coming from, what they want, really how to feel them. So they're just pulling you down. So that happiness, that contentment is really going to be affected. But we'll talk about some things to do. But as we process, as we get to know, as we gain wisdom, understand what they're wanting, where they're coming from, then that equalizer becomes a bit more balanced. You've got, you know, you're experiencing your fear and your anger and your sadness, and it's released in a sense. It's not being stuffed. So then it sounds strange, but if you're knowing those harder feelings, when you're experiencing happiness and joy, all of a sudden there's a resonance to it. You're experiencing some of it, its fullness. Does that make sense? Does that make with the? I know it's strange with these. Like, well, no, it's sadness, it's fear, it's anger. That's, you got to get rid of that. It's part of us. It's the messages that we have. So it's part of our EQ. It's part of that equalizer. So if they're getting their time and they're, you know, if you're dialing them in, then the happiness, the contentment, then you can hear it. Then you can feel it. It's like that JBL, you know, that JBL commercial. All of us old people in this room would sitting in front of the speakers and it's just blowing your hair back. You know, it's just this, oh, there it is. Max, there you go. Not JBL, Maxell. Thank you. There you go. Okay, so just some brief what to do, how to get to know your feelings. I think, and this word is to a lot of people kind of a dirty word, journaling. I hate journaling. I really do. I just all own it. You know, I don't like it. It's so effective. It's so helpful. It really makes me mad that it works that good. Okay. So kind of the quick and dirty of it, have a sad page, have a mad page, have a fear, anxiety page. Doesn't have to be something huge to practice this kind of journaling. I would suggest that you don't wait till something huge comes in, or maybe you're already in something, whatever huge means, but to be able to write down, I feel sad. There's been loss. And as I'm feeling this way, I'm thinking like this, and I'm kind of behaving like this. The who, what, when, where, and how of sadness. Not the easiest thing in the world to do. There will be tears, difficult feelings, uncomfortable, but you'll sit in it, you'll get to know it, and you'll write it, but be gracious, be patient, be gentle with yourself, and not to just do it to ruminate or just, you know, suffer in it, but saying, I want to get to know this feeling. What does this feeling want me to do? How do I process this? How do I walk in this? Anger, fear. Give time for each feeling. You know, if you realize you're writing and you're sad, and all of a sudden I'm actually angry. Find your anger page. This has turned to anger. Here's what it is. Here's what's going on. Here's the who, what, when, where, and why of my anger. Okay. Just a couple more minutes and we'll take a quick break. And then have Jackie come up. So people will say to me, when I'm praying and reading Scripture, I can't stop the feelings and thoughts from coming in. It's been a bad day, a bad month, a bad year. I'm trying to hang out with Jesus, and I got all this stuff flying through my head. So I've become a pretty big fan of meditation. Now, that may not be as bad of a word as journaling, or maybe meditation means that's even worse than journaling. I don't have any incense in my mouth and in my house. I don't have a sitar, you know, in the corner. Bing, you know. Okay, hang on. Before you generalize, or you know, meditation doesn't have to be spooky. Christians have been doing meditation for a long time, like 32 years or something like that. No. Couple thousand years. People have been, Christians have been meditating for a very, very long time. So we could spend hours talking about this, but we've got just a few minutes. You're meditating on gratitude. You're praying, you're like, all right, I've got my tea. I've got, you know, I've got Maranatha songs going on. It's the perfect situation. All right, I'm going to meditate on gratitude. Oh, my kids are such a pain in the butt. I don't know why. I'm so angry at my kids. Oh, there it is. Now it's ruined. You know, 12 seconds of meditation. So the idea is I'm meditating on gratitude. Thoughts are going to come. Feelings are going to show up. So the meditation, in a nutshell, here comes some anxiety. What if? What about tomorrow at work? What's going to happen? That meeting that I have going on. You don't get up. You don't stop breathing slowly. You keep your eyes closed and you say, okay, what? Ah, that's anxiety. That's that meeting I've got going on tomorrow. I'm going to put that on a leaf. I'm going to put that on a cloud. Eyes closed, you have Jesus right there with you, and just have Jesus hang out with you. Put it on a leaf, that anxiety, and on a stream, and let that stream take that leaf, literally just with your eyes closed, watching that leaf go by, and let it go all the way around, let it go around a bend, okay? Not like a straight, long Willamette River to where, like, for 12 minutes you're just watching. Let it go around a corner. Okay, now it's gone. Back to gratitude. For the first while, couple weeks, whatever, you're going to be interrupted a lot. But think about that structure. There's a great book by Sharon Salzberg, The Power of Meditation. Great book on the nuts and bolts of meditation. There's not any religious stamp that she puts on it. It's not Middle Eastern this or that or Christian. It just is, and I would highly recommend that book. I think it's called Real Happiness, Power of Meditation. Don't like the title, but a great one. And I think it's like a 31-day. It's a great question and answers, you know, Q&A section. What if this, what if that? What if my dog's barking? What if I'm angry? It's just a great book. In your walk, in your prayer time, applying meditation to deal with those emotions that are coming up as you're trying to get to know them, understand them, and what they're wanting. And then another book is called The Naked Now. Ooh, provocative. By a Franciscan monk. His name's Richard Rohr. Fantastic writer. Been a huge fan. And it's meditation, prayer, just sitting with Jesus. And thinking about Jesus, and meditation is not a lot of work. Just find some place to sit and be present with God. So, what do we say? We take just a couple of minutes, I know this is nice. This is fast and furious here. We're going to have some questions at the end for Jackie and I. So for like literally 2.5 or 3 minutes, stand, turn around, you know, if it's a friend, massage their back, turn around, you massage their back, and we will bring Jack in.
Thank you, Kevin. All right. So practical. I drew a picture on this board only because I heard George had the whiteboard brought in and neither of us had anything to write on it. So I guess what I want to say is that if you picture this in your mind after what Kevin has just said, is that if this is Mount Hood, our thoughts and our feelings are the weather on the mountain. But deeper than our thoughts and feelings, and it's the clouds, deeper, hidden with Christ in God, is our true life. And the mountain is solid. It's very, very, very solid. But our thoughts and feelings vary. And they come and go, and they're sunny, or they're stormy, or they're all different kinds of ways they can present themselves, but they always pass. So think of your feelings and your thoughts as the weather on the mountain. The mountain itself is solid, and our life is hidden with Christ in God, and that is deeply, deeply, deeply solid. So that's your only picture for the whiteboard. Hope that's a helpful picture. But what I guess I would say is that I want to, if you remember nothing other from what I'm going to say, I hope you remember everything Kevin says, but nothing more of what I'm going to say, it would be these few little things, and then I'm going to go back and kind of fill those in. My prayer for myself on a daily basis and for my family and friends and for my clients is that we would be, as Paul says in Ephesians 3, rooted and grounded in his love. And that with being rooted and grounded in his love, we would know what the breadth and the length and the height and the depth of the love of God is. My prayer is that we would all know that. As we know that, the degree to which we know that, I really believe, is a degree to which we walk healthily in the world. And so everything I say and do, and I know everything Kevin says and does, is to that end, that we in our personal lives, but also in what we do in our offices, that people would, as a result, be rooted and grounded in the love of God. Remember, nothing else, but we are wounded in relationships. We'll be healed in relationships. Second thing, nobody causes your feelings. Your feelings come from within you. You have responses to things. No matter how your feelings get there, maybe somebody has done something externally or whatever, but ultimately, no matter how your feelings get there, you are now responsible to figure out what to do with them. And so the example would be the difference between being controlled by what's outside of you versus being learning how to manage what's coming from within you. If I wanted it to be 70 degrees in here every day, and I opened those doors out there and left it open 365 days a year, how many days would it be 70 degrees in here? Probably not very many. And I would be at the mercy of the weather. However, if I set a thermostat at 70, 365 years a day, and internally regulated the temperature, it would vary somewhere between about 68 and 72 if I could learn how to internally regulate the weather. What I do and what Kevin does daily is to help people know how to internally regulate their own emotions, because no matter how it got there, what vehicle brought it, by the time it reaches us and when we have to decide what to do with it, it's now within us and it's our issue. It's our opportunity and our problem. And then third is remembering that Galatians 5 says that it is faith working through love. That is the whole way I organize everything I do. Tozer says, faith is the organ of knowledge, and love is the organ of experience. We need both those things, both knowledge and experience, to change. You could go to a million workshops, you could memorize the Bible, and still not be transformed internally, because that requires a true encounter with love and a true encounter internally. And so it's faith working through love. We need both of those things. So, again, you can ignore the next 10, 15 minutes, but not teasing. I have a typical example would be a couple sitting in my office, and the man says, you know what, I don't get it. I don't get it. I go to work every day. I make a good living. I provide. I come home. But it never feels like I've done enough. It never feels like, and it just doesn't feel like I have ever done enough for you to be happy with me. I'm always disappointing you. And you only have two kids, and you stay at home all day long. And when I get home, you say you're tired and you don't want sex. And I'm just resentful. And the woman turns right around and says, but I don't get it for you. I don't feel connected to you. I don't feel like we are a team. I don't feel like there's, yes, you do those things, but there's not that part that says, I matter to you. And then all of a sudden you want to have sex, and I'm tired. I'm really tired. And they both sit in my office, and they're in tears, and they both are crying, and they both say, we don't want a divorce, but we don't know what in the heck to do with these feelings. We are resentful. We're not even sure we like each other. And 3 years ago, we were madly in love with each other. Help. And then I had a friend of mine, this was when I was with Campus Crusade, say to me, I've got three feelings. I got to read these to you because I know I'll forget them. He said, I only have three feelings. And I was, yeah, I thought, okay. And these are the three feelings he said he has. Let me read these to you, because I thought this was rather interesting. How do I do this with one hand? It's right. Aha, there it is. Nope. Yes. He says, I feel love, I feel anger, and I feel commitment. And he was unaware that commitment really wasn't a feeling. So, and then he said, my wife and I started having problems, and everything went to hell in a handbasket. I couldn't get control of any of my feelings, and I was out to lunch. I didn't know where to turn or what to do. And that's why when people say to me, you know what, feelings aren't that big a deal, or what is the big deal around feelings, I will say, if you don't know what your feelings are and you're unable to regulate them, you're going to be in a lot of trouble in your life. Feelings tell us about ourselves. They tell us about others. They tell us about the world in which we live. Both pleasant feelings and painful feelings are an important part of life. Feelings draw us into relationships where we find healing. And feelings of pain tell us something is wrong and that we need some help, or we need to help someone else. Feelings motivate us to action, and feelings are part of how God made us. Yet if we don't understand our feelings, and if we don't own our feelings and learn to be wise and gentle in managing our feelings and transforming them, they can consciously or unconsciously control us, leading us into behaviors and decisions that are not in our best interest and not in the best interest of others. Feelings can rise up, and this is a part that has always astonished people in my office. Your feelings rise up and they conquer all your good intentions, and they lead us to make choices even against our own values. And people go, I don't know how in the world I did that. That's why feelings are a big deal. They really are a big deal. And I think Kevin talked about self-awareness, getting to know them. And that's going to be important. Let me go to the, by the way, anything I've ever said I said in my book. I read it this morning because I wanted to know if there was anything out of it that might be helpful. And I realized, oh, man, that's not a bad book. I really like that book. And I thought, I don't know if I can add a whole lot to it, so I'll just read from it. Anyway, I don't make a profit on this. Anything that is profit goes back to ministry, but so far it hasn't been profitable. I haven't broken even yet, but it's okay. I mean, I've a couple thousand copies, but compared to what I put into it, I don't think I brought too many, but if I'll leave some with George in the church, I can get them there tomorrow if these go quickly. But as we grow from childhood to adulthood, we learn skills without even knowing that we're doing it. For example, children raised in bilingual families, they don't remember learning both languages. They just know them both as they grow up. They just learned them and didn't even think about it. And what is true of cognitive skills, such as language acquisition, which is what learning a language is true of emotional skills too. And if we have had what I call good enough parenting, we don't need perfect parents. We need good enough parents. We naturally develop emotional life skills that will carry us through life. And we don't even usually know that we've done it. We just learn them. But if we haven't developed those, and we don't know we haven't developed those, they cause a lot of problems in our adult lives. So having said that real quick, I'm just going to give a real quick overview of development. I am a developmentalist, and what that means is that I look at how emotions get developed over time. And I studied quite a bit in terms of childhood all the way through adulthood. And basically, as you look at the skills that are taught in those years, those emotional life skills, we can go back and learn them if we didn't get them. But when a child is born, they are born into the world without any real sense of who they are. They pop into this cold world and they start to seek attachment or connection first off. And that's one important, powerful emotional life skill, the ability to attach and connect with meaning to another human being. And that that helped the child from that sense of isolation into a sense of, oh yeah, mom, I've got this. Okay, now they didn't say these words, but it's a feeling. And over the first 3 years of life, approximately, if the attachment is what it needs to be and that connection is what it needs to be with mom and other significant people in that child's life, they internalize a sense of self that says, I belong, I'm cared about, I'm loved. And that feeling begins to grow in them. If they had less than ideal parenting or abuse or all the other kinds of things that go on sometimes with children, instead of being able to internalize that feeling of, oh, it's safe to connect, I do belong, life is safe, people are safe, instead, they internalize a feeling of, I got to be careful. Something's wrong. Aloneness is better than connection. And so they don't develop that sense of a connected self. Now, the next phase, so that first phase is the ability to attach, the ability to connect. That's an emotional life skill. The second task and skill we learn in life is somewhere from around 3 to, let's say, 9, 10, 11, 12, and these are all relative, kind of arbitrary cutoffs. But that second one is the ability to have boundaries, the ability to have a separate self. And what happens as a baby grows, as they begin to see they're not the center of the universe, that mom has other people in their lives, the significant caregiver, if it's mom, sometimes it's dad, they begin to learn that, wait a minute, I'm not, and so they do everything they can to try and get to be the center of mom's universe again, but then brother comes along or sister comes along or somebody comes along and they learn that they're not the center of the universe. There are more than them in the world. And they begin to develop boundaries. Boundaries are where I end and other people begin. It's the feelings that are within me, the thoughts that are within me. I'm responsible for those, but I'm not responsible for the feelings and thoughts that are in another person. And so that begins to develop from about 3 to, let's say, 9, 10, 11. And without a sense of autonomy, boundaries, that sense of being able to make our own choices, letting our yes be yes and our no be no, without that ability, as adults, we cannot have true intimacy. It takes a true sense of separateness, our own sense of self and belonging, before we can truly connect with another person and have a deep, deep sense of intimacy. So attachment's one skill. The second skill is learning boundaries. And then the third skill is what I call an integration, integrated. It's that the ability to integrate. And what that is basically, it's the ability from about 10-ish to through our 20s, early 20s, this is the skill we're learning. And that skill that we're learning is the ability to not see everything as black and white, not to see everything as all or nothing, not to see my group as the best and that group as not the best. It is the ability to say, well, wait a minute. I love this person, but I also see that they're not perfect and they do some things sometimes that are insensitive and hurt my feelings. So I can either one minute feel like they're all good and the next minute feel like they're all bad and be on a roller coaster, or I can really look at that person and say, wait a minute, you've got good and bad, I've got good and bad. Let's see if we can't talk and work this out. Let's see if we can't be two imperfect people in this world and find purpose and meaning. So that ability to integrate, to not see everything as all or nothing, to not see everything as black and white, is an important life skill. And I call it the ability to integrate. And so that's a skill that we learn that is really, really important. And if we don't learn it, we get stuck in this all or nothing place. I have often thought that the church in America is kind of stuck in that stage. You know, we're kind of in that place where we have to have the exact answers. We have to be able to give, for every problem in the world, we have to have an answer. And if you don't believe exactly this, then you're not okay. Instead of recognizing, here's where we have our life. It's hidden with Christ in God. And that's a mystery. That is a mystery. And we don't have all the answers. But he is in us and we are in him. All of life has its meaning in him and draws all of meaning from him. So then the last one is, people call it different things. I call it developing adulthood, developing the ability to be an adult in the world. And what that means, it's a, how would I say, an integrated self, a responsible self. That's what I call it. The responsible self, that as we go through these four life tasks, we get to that place as adults where we withdraw our need to have somebody have authority over us, and we put that in God as our authority, and we don't any longer need anyone else to have authority over us, to tell us what to do, to tell us what to think, to tell us what we believe, to tell us when we're right, to tell us when we're wrong, because we've developed that within us, and our true authority is God. And that takes years. And may I say, with all of these life skills, it takes a lot of years. And they circle back and forth. They don't just happen chronologically. And I guess what I want to say in these life skills is that we have to be patient, because most people that I know are lacking in these in some place or another. most of us have areas where we've been wounded, and when we've been wounded, if we haven't had a safe place like Kevin talked about to deal with it or experience our feelings and have somebody help us work it over, those went into hiding. And then we develop defenses around that. And then somebody gets near us and accidentally bumps into our little defense, and there we go. And then there they go. And then we match theirs and they match ours. And then before you know it, we're in World War III. So be patient with it. And so that's just a brief, brief developmental view of how we grow emotionally as kids. And so I'm going to say a couple other things because I'm aware of the time and I'm aware of wanting you guys to be able to ask some questions. But let me get back here where I'm. So briefly, I'm going to mention four other life skills that I think are important. Kevin mentioned it, so I'm not going to say much else about it. But self-awareness, that's an emotional life skill that we all need to have. And I'm going to just read the definition so that I don't confuse you with my many words, which I can do. The ability to observe, observe what is going on around you and within you in the present moment. It includes the ability to label your feelings and stay with them. That means to feel them and not repress them. And two, you decide what to do with them. It also involves the ability to describe what you see and feel, and this is key, without judgment. Self-aware people know their strengths and weaknesses, and they're open to growth. Second one is containment of feelings. It's like having a container. And this is the ability to hold or contain your feelings within your own boundary lines. An example is feeling angry and being able to talk about it without exploding, yelling, or throwing things. If you do the latter, it's called spilling over onto someone else and making them the container for our big feelings. Another example would be overreacting to an event, sobbing, screaming, collapsing, and expecting someone else to fix it for you. So that ability to contain our feelings is really, really important as adults. Self-comfort or self-soothing is an important emotional life skill. It's the ability to soothe ourselves, to nurture yourself emotionally when painful feelings well up within you. For example, you've had a draining day at work. You're looking forward to going home and talking to your wife about it. You've forgotten she has a school board meeting that evening. Totally frustrated, you have to decide how you're going to comfort yourself. Positive ways to do so might be to pray, to call a friend, to go for a run, cook your favorite meal, or read the paper. Negative ways to comfort yourself or soothe yourself might be drinking too much, eating too much, feeling sorry for yourself, using pornography, barking at the kids, or being grumpy and taking it out on your wife when she returns home. To develop the skill of self-comfort, you need to take the time to get to know yourself and develop numerous healthy forms of comfort. I challenge people to find 12 different things that are forms of self-soothing. I say take the next month, and when you're struggling and you find something that really helps you, write it down and keep a list of the things that help you self-soothe. Because when you have a hard situation come, you might not be able to do that quickly. And so you want to have a toolbox full of things that will help you self-soothe. Another one is empathy or compassion. The ability to feel compassion for yourself and for others through the painful part of life, the hurts, the failures, the losses. Empathy also includes the ability to feel joy in life and to share the joy of others. Compassion, loving kindness, and mercy are inseparable. Having empathy involves developing an attitude of compassion and curiosity instead of an attitude of condemnation and judgment toward yourself and others. I'm going to say that again, and I would hope you memorize this. I kind of make my clients memorize it because I say it so much, but develop an attitude of curiosity rather than an attitude of condemnation. Develop an attitude of curiosity rather than an attitude of condemnation. In Romans chapter 7, we see a terrible struggle in the Apostle Paul as he's talking. And he says that famous stuff, "Oh, wretched man that I am, who's going to set me free? What I don't want to do, I do, and what I want to do, I don't do." And he's struggling. He's really struggling. And you see the answer given isn't to hate the self. It's not any of those things. The answer given is Romans 8. "There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and death." And basically, as you look at all of that, when we want to condemn either ourselves or someone else, we're somewhere running on that treadmill of performance, self-evaluation, judgment, condemnation, and we need to shift our focus to the life hidden with Christ in God. Let the thoughts and feelings about the situation pass, reaffirm who we are in Christ. Deep breath, meditation, journaling, hot bath, whatever we're going to do until our overreactive feelings calm down. And that's an important thing to help them calm down. And what I would say is there are three things necessary to the development of our Christian life as people who love and walk and follow Jesus Christ. He is the embodiment of grace and truth. Before, after the fall of mankind and before he came, it seemed as though grace and truth were split apart. We had the legalists, and then we had the people that were grace-oriented and, you know, whatever happens, happens, it doesn't matter. Scripture tells us in John 1 that God brought it all back together, grace and truth, in Christ. And what I tell people is give yourself time and be patient. If you look at Mark and he tells a parable of the farmer who wanted to grow a garden, and it says he took that seed and he made sure it was in, this is my paraphrase, made sure it was in fertile soil, made sure it was watered, made sure it was the right time of year and the sun was there, and then the appropriate rain, and then he went to bed. And when he woke up, it had grown. Because the DNA to grow is inside the seed. The DNA for us to grow is in us. God created us with the DNA to grow. And if we will cultivate the right environment, we can't control it, we can't will it, we can't force it. But if we will create the right environment, we will grow. And that environment is grace mixed with love and giving it time. Grace, truth, and time. Grace mixed with truth and time. I'm real aware of the time. And I'm real aware that we've got about 15 minutes left, and I don't. So I'm kind of just rounding that out real quick. Again, most of what I've said is in here. And Kevin, come up. And what I would like to do is maybe just all of you take a deep breath, hold it, and let it out. Do you know that that right there is self-soothing? It calms you, causes a heart rate to go down. It gets you a little bit more grounded. And it really is a healthy thing to do. Deep breath.
Do you want to thank Kevin and Jackie? And just thank you guys so much. That's just really, really, really helpful. And I know doing it in an hour and a half is really an impossibility, but you guys did great. And so this is, you taught this class one time, a six-week class, so, you know, you got the crash course. And, I want to pray a blessing over us, and, may the God of peace completely sanctify all of us in our bodies, in our soul, in our spirit, and in our mind. And may we continue on the journey with him and with one another.